Most people don't know how many financial accounts they have or their net worth. And when you're not paying attention, you're leaving money on the table. The solution is Monarch, an all-in-one personal finance tool that brings your entire financial life together in one clean interface on your laptop or phone. In just minutes, link all your accounts for a complete picture of your financial health. You'll never need a spreadsheet again. Get 50% off your first year, that's just $50 total, at monarch.com with code BUDGET. That's monarch.com, promo code BUDGET.
We've all done it. Stock our fridge with leafy greens and good intentions, only to have our future self sacrifice quality nutrition for the convenience of takeout. Keep your body and mind nourished all day with a whole body meal shake from Kachava. It's got 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, and so much more. But the best part? It actually tastes delicious. With 6 indulgent flavors to choose from, it's easy to make a superfood-packed shake. From chocolate, vanilla, and chai, to matcha, coconut acai, and strawberry, you've got endless ways to personalize your Kachava. Whether you prefer it straight up or enjoy adding fruit, peanut butter, nut milk, or even iced coffee, with every 2 scoops of Kachava, you're getting 85-plus superfoods, nutrients, and plant-based ingredients. Shop now through December 2nd to get 30% off your first purchase of 2 or more bags with code NEWS at Kachava.com. That's 30% off for a limited time at KACHAVA.com, code NEWS.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. My name is Zachary Mallory, and I am the founder and the host of the Rise Above Justice Movement and the Rise Above Justice Movement, the podcast. Today, I will give a very detailed viewer discretion is advised due to the nature of the topics that we will be discussing. Today, I am joined by an incredible human being, Emily. Welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast.
Hi, Zachary. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. It's an absolute honor. And this one definitely has been a long time in the, you know, in the makes.
Yeah, and for sure.
Scheduling is always very tricky, especially the closer we get to the holidays, which, you know, the holidays can bring out the best or the worst in people. And unfortunately, what I've been seeing is it's bringing out the worst, especially with everything that is going on in the world, in the United States, with food stamps being cut and Medicaid potentially on the chopping block and SSI potentially and a number of other things. And then, you know, we still have unhoused community members and still have domestic violence and sexual violence running rampant in our communities. But, you know, let's focus on your experiences, your story. Feel free to introduce yourself to our audience and feel free to ramble, my friend. I'm so excited to sit down and talk to you today. It is an absolute honor.
Oh, thank you so much. That actually means the world, especially coming from you. And I think I'm really excited for today as well, just to be able to chat with you. It is an honor as well to be here and to be connected to you. I think we've been connected for like a year now since the beginning of some of the movements on Instagram. But yeah, so for folks who may be wondering, who is Emily Quint? I am Emily Quint. I live in Canada. I'm a survivor of sexual violence, intimate partner violence, and a criminal legal system that nearly broke me. I'm the author of My Sunflower Soul, a memoir, and I'm currently a Master's of Social Work student, completing my placement at Guelph Wellington Women in Crisis. So it's a nonprofit organization in the town or in the city of Guelph in Ontario, supporting survivors of gender-based violence. So that looks like sexual violence, intimate partner violence, as well as human trafficking. So it's really interesting working in that space, being both a professional as well as a survivor. And so it's teaching me a lot, things that I certainly thought that I knew. And there's a lot of reframing that's been going on. So it's honestly, it's an incredible organization and a wonderful opportunity. And my goal kind of after I do graduate is to work in this space. So work with survivors, work alongside survivors. I think it's so important that folks who work in that space also have that lived experience, that lived expertise. So I guess a little bit more about my experiences. As a survivor, I've made three very different choices in my life. So in 2016, after surviving intimate partner violence, I made the choice not to report. I often refer to myself as, when I left that relationship, I was a shell of a human. It felt like really he had leached onto me and sucked me dry. And so after that relationship, it was a lot about learning to rebuild. And for me, I needed to be the focus. And I figured jumping into the justice system, I wouldn't be able to find myself. I wouldn't be able to heal. And then 6 years later, so fast forward to 2022, I was sexually assaulted by an acquaintance in my own home. And so after that, I made a very different choice. I was angry. I was hurt. I felt like my whole worldview had collapsed and crumbled right in front of me. I was like, how can I be safe in this world again? So I stepped into the criminal legal system believing that if I just showed up, told the truth, and followed the rules, it would lead to justice. Unfortunately, it led to complete and utter devastation. When I arrived at the courthouse on the first day of the scheduled trial, I was told that there were no staff available to hear the case. They assured me that they would do their best to find a team, so I sat and waited, my heart pounding, my stomach in knots, every nerve bracing for the moment I would get to speak my truth out loud. By the afternoon, the Crown came out and told me that I could go home. The trial wouldn't move forward that day after all. I was so confused because I just thought that if I did everything that was asked of me, things would kind of fall into place. And all of a sudden, I was met with something that I didn't even know was possible, that I could show up and there weren't staff to hear the case out. The next morning, I gathered my strength again. I dressed, showed up, and sat on that same wooden bench with the same racing heart rate, trying to steady my breath. Once again, I was told that there were not enough staff to proceed. Another day wasted, another day of my life on hold, another day of gearing myself up for the hardest testimony of my life, only to be sent away like my time, my trauma, and my voice were not worth the system's resources. By the final day of the scheduled trial, they finally called me to the stand. I had carried the weight of anticipation and dread for days, with no control over whether I would actually be heard. When I began to testify, the cross-examination ripped open wounds that I had barely begun to close. It was excruciating. And I had done a lot of preparation prior to. I had met with a lawyer who had kind of walked me through what the process would look like, and what they believed the defense's route would be. And so it was the route of consent. It was around Emily consented to this. She wanted it. Whereas I don't know how somebody who is sleeping could consent or want anything. But after that, as hard as testifying and cross-examination was, I felt such a sense of relief afterwards because it was like, okay, I've done my part. I did everything that was asked of me. I waited, I reported, I prepared, I relived the darkest memories. And so it was like, okay, I can move on, or not move on, I can move forward from this. But 4 months later, just 1 week before a trial was set to resume, I was told that the case had been stayed. That broke me. Everything that I had poured into this, it was like it didn't matter. The case wasn't stayed, not because the harm wasn't real and not because the evidence wasn't strong, but because too much time had passed. The delays, the cancellations, the days showed up, or the days I showed up ready, and was turned away, all of it had added up. And so in Canada, we have the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and Section 11B states that the accused has a right to a timely trial. And so in provincial or state level offenses, that time frame is 18 months. And so after a case has been in the system for 18 months, the defense can put through a motion to have the charges stayed. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. It just goes ahead. So in the end, his right to a timely trial mattered more than my right to be heard. In that single moment, hearing that the case had been stayed, everything I had endured to get to court, the hours of preparation, the courage it took to relive my trauma, and the cost of dragging my heart through the process over and over again was erased. At the end of the day, the man who harmed me walked free without accountability, without consequence, and I was left standing there with the pieces of my heart, my voice, and my belief in justice scattered at my feet. And I think what I learned that day is that sometimes it's not the violence itself that breaks us completely open. Don't get me wrong, the violence is awful and we never deserve it and it never should have happened. But what hurt me even more was the way that the very system that promised protection can betray us so completely. For me, it wasn't just that he walked free. It was that my voice, my pain, and my truth had been made invisible. And so my story doesn't actually stop there. This past summer, I found myself confronting another layer of trauma. Sometimes they say, when you get out of survival mode, that's when things come back and hit you, things that you have repressed or suppressed so deeply. And so what came up for me was a historic sexual assault that happened 11 years ago, shortly after I had experienced, or shortly after I had finished chemotherapy treatment. The assault was by my cousin, someone who should have been safe, someone that my family trusted, and someone that I trusted. And so for years, that memory lived buried in silence. It was too heavy to carry, but too painful to release. And when it resurfaced, I was faced with another choice. Like, do I tell anyone? And then from there, do I report, knowing the cost, knowing what the system demands of survivors? Or do I take another route? Do I protect myself this time? And I think for the first time, I made this decision with clarity, not with fear. And so I chose not to report. And it's not because the harm wasn't real, not because my voice doesn't matter, but because I refuse to walk back into a system that already destroyed me once before. I refuse to. How could I step back into a system that I poured my heart and soul into? And I was met with doors slammed shut. So instead, I've actually reached for something different, and I've reached for restorative justice services. I'm currently on a wait list here in Ontario, I would say even throughout Canada, and I don't want to speak for the US, but I imagine through the US, like restorative justice pathways are extremely limited. There's a lack of funding. And so I've been on a wait list since August, I believe. But honestly, for the first time, the path forward doesn't feel like it's about being forced into someone else's process. It's about finding one that actually honors my truth. And so in the meantime, I'm healing with my family, my therapist, my community, and in the quiet work I do on my own terms. And I think what's so remarkable is I'm doing better than I ever could have imagined because for the first time, I feel like I get to define what justice means for me. It doesn't have to look like punishment or re-traumatization. It doesn't have to mean being funneled through a system that has already shown me it does not care about me. I get to choose my own healing and I get to choose my own justice. And it's all done on my own terms. So, yeah, that's a little bit about me, my experiences as a survivor of two sexual assaults and then intimate partner violence, which had sexual violent elements to it as well. But as well as my experience within our justice system and how going forward, I will advocate for multiple pathways to justice and healing because no one deserves to experience what I have and what so many other survivors have.
You reclaimed your truth, reclaimed your power, reclaimed your voice, and you're a badass human because of it. And that's all I
Oh,
gotta say.
Zachary.
Because that is what you call power and reclaiming what has been taken, turning it into rage, but then also taking that rage and turning it into action and advocating for other people who may be going through the same thing that you did. You are the definition of a warrior, my friend, because it's literally turning that into something that is going to help others and help create that change that future generations are going to look back and they're going to reflect on. They're going to say, hey, this group of people did this, we can do this, and take it even further and advocate for the true decolonization within the justice systems across the world, right? Because there's a lot. Colonization is not just specific to the United States. It's also Canada, Australia, UK, everywhere else. But
Most people don't know how many financial accounts they have or their net worth. And when you're not paying attention, you're leaving money on the table. The solution is Monarch, an all-in-one personal finance tool that brings your entire financial life together in one clean interface on your laptop or phone. In just minutes, link all your accounts for a complete picture of your financial health. You'll never need a spreadsheet again. Get 50% off your first year. That's just $50 total at monarch.com with code BUDGET. That's monarch.com, promo code BUDGET.
I did not know what restorative justice was for the longest time, and I thought people were absolutely crazy whenever they said that. I was like, restorative justice? I was like, what the fuck do you mean restorative justice? So I was like, you can't restore justice. But then I learned about the true roots of it, and it's decolonizing within itself because there's a lot that goes into that. So what I would love is, to talk more about what restorative justice is to you, what it looks like to you, and what we can do as a society to recognize the need for those alternative methods of reporting directly to police. Because there are a lot of other routes. So I would love for you to walk through that journey with me and walk people through what restorative justice looks like. Because there's also transformational justice too. So RJ and TJ. And yeah, just walk us through. What does it look like
Yeah,
to you?
absolutely. And I think you bring up such a good point around decolonization. So, in my social work studies, I've learned so much about colonization and how even just decolonizing social work practice, because social workers historically, and I would argue currently, it's a Eurocentric profession that has played a large role in Canada in residential schools as well as 60 Scoop. And so I think in my professional life and also in my personal life, decolonization is so important. And so when I first learned about restorative justice, I actually took a workshop and the Indigenous individual who was leading the workshop shared with us, like, in our world, we don't actually view it as restorative justice. It's simply a way of life. Through everything that we do, we are attempting to restore and repair. And so that was so beautiful to hear and to remind all of us who are attempting to decolonize and who are advocating for other pathways to justice and healing, that this is actually a way of life for the people who first inhabited this land. And so, for me specifically, restorative justice is really about bringing humanity back into the process. As I've shared, and as other folks have shared on this incredibly powerful podcast, our traditional criminal legal systems lack humanity. And so restorative justice is about bringing that humanity back into the process, and it's about centering survivors. I think, and Zachary, we have talked about this before, but there's this big narrative right now that the criminal justice system or criminal legal system is broken. And it's interesting because when you do hear all these stories, you think, you know what, it is broken. But as we've talked about, it's not actually broken. It's actually functioning exactly as it was intended to. And so with restorative justice, it's actually about centering survivors, not centering the accused, not centering the perpetrator, but actually asking the survivor, what do you need to heal and what would repair look like for you? When I entered the justice system, nobody asked me once, Emily, what do you want? What are you hoping to get out of this, right? And so if I would have shared with them punishment, I want this person to go to jail. I want them, you know, to experience neglect. I want this, I want that. Then, okay, navigate that process, navigate that system. But that's never what I wanted. And no one ever asked me. So I didn't know any better. And so I come back to this time and time again. But what I really wanted out of this process was therapy for both of us, an attempt at repair and accountability, as well as healing, right? And so as people have heard today with my story, I thought that I was going down that route, but it actually got us much further away from that healing. It caused more trauma, more pain, and more harm. And so for me, restorative justice, I think it doesn't excuse that harm. And it doesn't mean that there are no consequences. It means meaningful consequences, ones that actually promote accountability, empathy, and repair instead of punishment for punishment's sake. It gives space for acknowledgement, impact, and even sometimes transformation. And so for me, when I think about my healing journey, restorative justice reflects the exact same values that guide my healing: honesty, empathy, courage, and the belief that people can change. So to me, restorative justice isn't just a theory. It's not just a practice. It's actually a reflection of how I've chose to live, advocate, and heal.
And I've said it before, you know, like, healing is not linear. It is complex, and it is quite the journey. And it's not the easiest task in the world. You know, it's kind of like being asked, well, why didn't you just leave? Or, you know, what were you wearing? Or, you know, did you know this person? Like, there's a lot that I can say here. Because, yeah, you know, statistically speaking, majority of sexual assaults are somebody that you know.
Yeah.
However, that is not the case in every single situation, because there are people like Jeffrey Epstein.
Yeah.
That literally are running through our communities. You know, Jeffrey Epstein may no longer be on this earth, but there's a lot more people that mimic Jeffrey Epstein. And they idolize him, and they look at him as this hero, right? And he was set on this pedestal. But in reality, he ruined thousands of lives.
Yeah.
You know, and I sit back and I reflect on that. And, you know, sitting down and I think interviewing Jess Michaels, you know, a 1991 Jeffrey Epstein survivor, I think that opened my eyes a lot. It really did. And I'm getting ready to sit down and talk to a couple others too. And also talk to a Harvey Weinstein survivor too. And I think it's, you know, it's very interesting to kind of sit back, and these men are so incredibly harmful. And I know not all men, but always men. I've come to realize that. But what has healing looked like to you? Because, you know, again, as I said, it's not linear. It is complex and it looks different for each person. So what did healing look like to you? And are you still on the healing journey? Because honestly, I feel that, you know, healing takes years and years, if not decades, to even get to the point where you semi feel okay, you know. But then I also think about the people who literally grow up in that generational trauma where healing isn't possible. It literally is just this cycle of abuse and this cycle of violence that just continues on and on and on and on. So the question is, do you really feel like healing is done?
What a great question. I think when I look back to the version of me who survived the intimate partner violence, after that, I was like, okay, I need to heal. And to do that, it's going to be X, Y, Z, and that's like a checklist. And once that's done, I'm healed. I'm healed. This will never impact me. We're good to go. We're good to move forward. Life will be great again. Kind of like sunshine and rainbows perspective. I really lacked knowledge and understanding of the damage that intimate partner violence and sexual violence has on a person. Like, honestly, I never ever could have imagined until I navigated it. And so that was 2016 when I left that relationship. It still impacts me to this day. And same with both of the sexual violence incidences, as well as what happened with the criminal legal system. And so to answer your question, in my eyes, healing is truly lifelong. I said this to my therapist once. I said, you know what? I can believe I'm healed all I want, but I'm going to carry all of this with me in little pieces, in little ways for the rest of my life. And so for me, healing, this is like so cliche, but like healing is truly not a destination. It's not a one and done. It's lifelong. And I think especially when we've experienced relational harm, we can think that we've healed and we can think that we've done the work, and triggers will just pop up left, right, and center. I think that's such, it shows the power of our brain and our body. Even if we think that we've processed everything or that we are safe, there are still things that mimic or reflect the traumas that we've endured. And so there are moments of feeling that instability again. And so a huge, huge part of my healing is meeting myself where I'm at, because some days are sunshine and rainbows. Like, some days joy is big and bright and beautiful, and I'm embracing it with open arms and loving being alive. And some days it's about not feeling that, you know, the darkness, the clouds, the pain, physical, emotional, needing to lay down for a bit, needing to cry. And so what I've really learned through my healing journey is it's okay however I feel that day. And there's no pressure to act as if I'm where I want to be, because you learn so much about yourself and your strength and your resilience and your determination when you keep going when life is dark. And so that's such an integral piece for me around crying when I need to. Like, it's so healing in and of itself, because we're actually releasing those emotions and that pain. It's not getting stuck in our body. And so that's like a little bit of my perspective on healing. I believe that this will be lifelong, and I'm prepared for it to be lifelong, and I've made peace with that. And so I think there's such a strength and a comfort in knowing that, you know what, for the rest of my life, I get to treat myself softly. I get to treat myself with grace. I get to meet myself as I am and know that regardless of what it is, we're going to get through it together.
You know, and that's a sense of community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a sense of being around other people who just happened to understand and happened to get it. And in the digital age on social media, we know that survivor voices are heavily censored. Yeah. And progressive voices are heavily censored on social media. What's been your experience with censorship on social media and trying to get your story out there, but also your book, but also about the need for restorative justice? What have you seen?
That's such an interesting question. I think I bring a lot of different experience, like life experiences. So with my book, yes, obviously it talks about my experience with sexual violence, intimate partner violence, as well as what happened within the criminal legal system. But I also share things about growing up with childhood anxiety and panic attacks, depression, a close friend dying by suicide in high school, and then struggling with alcohol use, disordered eating, and then at 20 years old being diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma, a type of cancer, and all of a sudden having to endure chemotherapy. And then kind of in later years getting into the relational violence and the relational trauma. And so while I've been attempting to promote my book, I'm not a marketer, so it's going as it's going. And that's okay. I think, you know what, I've already done what I've set out to do, because I've had 10, 20, 30 people reach out and say, you know what, me too. Like, thank you for making me feel less alone. But to backtrack a little bit, what's been interesting is when I share things about surviving cancer, the views just rake in. Like, people love a cancer survivor story. But when I share aspects of sexual violence, intimate partner violence, I know that there's a community out there of people who care. But as you said, it just gets censored. Like, the views just aren't there, as opposed to when I share about going through chemotherapy and surviving cancer at 20 years old. It's like a night and day difference. Like, that stuff just gets pushed out. So it's really interesting, because I've had to kind of do some work on my own around, like, it doesn't mean that cancer is, you know, worse and is like the big selling point of my book, right? Because to me, that's only a little piece. And so there's been a lot, as I mentioned, like a lot of work that I've had to do on my own around, like, it's a piece of my story. These other aspects are also pieces of my story, but it has been very, very interesting to see it unfold in the digital age where, some, like, traumas, I guess, if you will, are viewed in a different lens. And whether that's censorship or algorithms or whatnot, or people just caring more because they don't view it as political, I have no idea. But it's made me realize, like, that's where I want to direct my attention to, right? Like, why is this happening? And why is it viewed in this way? So yeah, that's such an incredible question. And one I had, like, you know, now that you've asked it, I'm like, whoa, bells are going off in my head. But yeah, I don't know if you have any thoughts about that. I'm just kind of like processing that, like, what the hell?
So anybody who follows us on social media knows that we're very vocal about everything that's kind of going on. A massive election tomorrow in New York City. And, you know, also like Proposition 50 across, you know, in California. But there's a lot of things that I'm starting to realize, you know, as I run the social media, because I'm the main one that runs like our social media accounts. Okay. So we have close to 230,000 on Instagram, which, again, you know, you've been following for a while now. You know how quick it has grown. But even with having 230,000 followers or almost 230,000 followers on Instagram, and then also 33,000 on Threads, which, you know, together is close to like 260,000 followers. But then you also add in like our Blue Sky and, like, you know, our Facebook and things like that, which they're not very active. It's mainly Instagram and Threads. But even with having close to 230,000 followers, our viewership is completely down. It is barely over 4 million in the last 30 days, which I realize 4 million is still quite a few people viewing the, you know, the content. However, you would think it would be way higher. Now, I will tell you this, during the height of the election, it did hit like close to like 40 million. Okay. But we didn't have 230,000 followers at that time. This has happened over the last couple of months where we've been doing some very heavy organizing, collaborating with other content creators and other movements. And, you know, Marley and Survivors for Justice Reform has helped us grow astronomically, which, you know, I'm grateful for. But there's also other movements like Dear White Staffers and a couple other collaborators that we collaborate a lot with. And our viewership is completely down because we don't censor. We don't censor on social media. Mm-hmm. I have noticed that if I do censor, it does get a lot more views. But, you know, if you add in, you talk about like a rapist, right? You have to put the asterisk where the A in rapist is. And it's so incredibly annoying. Yeah. It really is. Because it will get shadow banned. It will get censored. And we are heavily censored and heavily shadow banned. And I have noticed it quite a bit. Not only with our account, but also some other accounts. I know Survivors for Justice Reform has also been censored on social media. A lot of the other progressive content creators have been censored on social media. And it is a very heavy thing that continues to get even worse. And then you start talking about elections and everything, and then it really begins to censor. So yeah, we've been noticing quite a bit about it, and it's wild to sit back and watch and think about. It is absolutely bonkers. I don't think anybody says bonkers anymore, but I just did. So you know, I'm kind of showing my age here, but you know, kind of shifting gears. You know, what is next for you? So you wrote this book, and you know, you share your story. You talk very candidly about your experiences with, you know, surviving cancer, which, you know, my mom is also going through cancer. Yeah. Mm-hmm. She was diagnosed with stage 3C cervical cancer in April. She has since finished her internal, external, and chemotherapy. Mm-hmm. So now she is at home resting comfortably. She is still independent. She is still a fireball. She's starting to get her energy back, but also starting to get her, you know, just reclaim her livelihood.
Yeah.
She's been doing a really good job with taking care of herself. And yeah, you know, what's next for you? Obviously, there might be something you can't talk about necessarily. Like, you know, we have some burial projects coming up with our movement, but I can't talk about this yet because we're still in the works. But what's next for Emily? What are you looking at doing? And kind of dive into that a little bit.
So first, I just want to send your mom, as well as you, so much love. It's not easy. And I know how close you two are and how supportive I can imagine you've been through it all. And I think, you know, as someone who has also navigated it, this is interesting, but it's kind of, I don't know if it's a hot take or not, but I'm so glad that it was me who had to go through it rather than one of my loved ones, because I felt like in that sense that I could control it, even though I couldn't. But I can only imagine how challenging it is to watch someone that you love so deeply go through something that is so scary, is so hard. And I know those are just words. But just know I'm sending you and your mom so much love and good vibes and well wishes and health. And then kind of in terms of what's next for me, I think that's a great question. I'm also kind of navigating some fertility challenges. And so my husband and I were trying to grow our family, and it hasn't gone according to plan. So in my mind, that's my number one priority while I also heal. And then, you know, at the same time, there are definitely some exciting things that are coming through Survivors for Justice Reform, as well as some collaboration with the incredible Marley Liss. But in terms of like just me on my own, my goal right now is really to finish my Master's of Social Work. So I finish next December. And then from there, I believe that I will likely go into private practice. So supporting victims and survivors, however they wish to identify in that work, as well as at the same time doing presentations and speaking engagements at different levels. So the advocate in me, and as you mentioned, like that fiery piece, the one who was so angry and was so hurt and knew that if I didn't transform that pain and that rage into something, that it would envelop me. That part of me is not gone. I know now my heart belongs in this work. And so I'm here to stay. I've talked a little bit about a potential second book. This would be in years, but would really speak to more about my healing journey, because the book, it's a memoir. So it talks basically about from the time I was born until April 2024, when I officially started my healing journey. And then at the end, there's some healing strategies as well as some learnings. And so what I've imagined would be a second book to kind of complement the first one, that would talk more about specifically what my healing has looked like. And I mean, as I mentioned, healing's lifelong, so I could write that maybe in 20 years, who knows? But I have found so much of my healing has come through writing. And I want to say putting pen to paper, but it's more putting fingertips to keyboard. And yeah, there's been so much healing, so much processing, so much growth from like sitting down and looking at like what I've navigated and where I am now. It's like a night and day difference. While still holding on to who I once was, because she's just as deserving as love as the current version of me. But yeah, exciting things. I'm always open to collaborations. And, you know, as we've talked about, I truly believe in community. And like, you know, if community didn't exist, we wouldn't be having this conversation right now. We wouldn't even know each other. And so it is so beautiful. It is so powerful. And it's something that I just want to soak in and just hold and love and allow it to create that light in my life.
I love how you just phrase that, create the light in my life. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's incredible. And I think you have a very impactful voice and a very powerful story that I think resonates with anybody that you encounter. And I think it's just so powerful to see somebody reclaim that voice, reclaim that time, reclaim that energy, and do the decolonization. Not only, because decolonization is not just in our communities, it's also within ourselves.
Absolutely.
That is something that I have come to realize. That is something that I have come to recognize. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with that, is there anything else you wanted to share with our listeners today?
I think I just want other survivors to know that if you're listening to this and you're having a hard time, whether it's a hard day or a hard period of time, I want you to know that you're not broken. You are surviving something that you were never meant to carry, and you were actually never meant to carry it alone either. Mm-hmm. Harm happens in relationship, but so too does healing. And so there's no single right way to heal, but I'm with you. I believe in you, and just know that you deserve to find the path that brings you peace.
Yes. Yes. And yes. Absolutely.
Preach.
So with that being said, you know, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. You know, I appreciate you. You know that I love everything about you. You bring this energy. You bring this spirit that is so nurturing and so healing. And I am grateful to be connected to you. And you know, you have an open invite anytime you have anything else you want to share on the podcast.
Aww. And
with that, please take care of yourself. Know that you are not alone. And know that you have a voice that will continue to leave the rippling effects in a positive way across the globe, not only in Canada, but also in the United States, but also just everywhere. So thank you for coming on the podcast today. I greatly appreciate you.
Thank you for having me. Sending you all the love.
Likewise. Thank you, my friend. Take care of yourself, okay?
You too. Thank you.
We've all done it. Stock our fridge with good intentions, only to sacrifice nutrition for convenience. Keep your body and mind nourished with whole body meal shakes from Kachava. It's got 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, and so much more. But it actually tastes delicious. Try one of Kachava's indulgent flavors today. Shop now through December 2nd to get 30% off your first purchase of 2 or more bags. Go to kachava.com and use code NEWS. That's KACHAVA.com, code NEWS.